Hi, and welcome to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Actually, recording off-site today at the Star Chefs 2010 ICC. That's the International Culinary Congress. Lucky enough to have Jordan Kahn, about to open up Red Medicine out in Beverly Hills, California with me, an old friend. Actually met him at Varietal, New York. Short-lived, but very emphatic restaurant that Jordan got to express his pastry prowess, his plate, in such a way that I don't think New York or even the country had seen before, with a real understanding and basis in the arts. Here at Star Chefs, he just did a funny little class about color. Can you explain a little bit about the idea behind that?
Sure. Antoinette asked me to do a demonstration for a workshop, and usually they're sort of kind of serious, and it's usually about like the chef, you know, showing you how to do something that you've never done, and like, you know, isn't this cool or isn't this interesting? Well, shouldn't you be impressed, kind of thing. And I wanted it to be interactive, but also like really fun, and for people to get something out of it without it being super sort of serious and over the top. So what we did is we started exploring, you know, how it's a subject that's been talked about for years and years, but it's how color perceives, you know, how color perception changes your you know, sense of taste and smell and things like that. So we basically just made a bunch of mise en place, purees, mousses, cakes, crumbs, nougatines, everything. We made it, we brought it with us, and we made everybody put on these visors that had the color of the visor was red, and it was such a saturated red that when you were wearing it, you couldn't see anything else, and everything was deep, deep red, and it skewed the color such that everything just looked like shades of red. You couldn't tell what the color of anything was. Also, to play a second trick on people, we changed the colors of certain mise en place to what it was supposed to be. So banana puree was green, and you know, peach puree was bright red, but also peach puree was bright yellow. So, you know, we sort of, you know, we had green ice cream flavored with romaine lettuce. So, you know, we did a lot of familiar stuff and some unfamiliar stuff to sort of throw people off. We did.
So it's actually kind of like the opposite of seeing the world through rose-colored glasses.
Exactly. You know, and so at the end of it, people just sort of, they split off into groups. They got to take as much mise en place as they wanted. They tasted it. They interacted with it. They, you know, could put it in a, they could whip it, they could, you know, whisk it, they could, you know, do whatever they wanted with it, bake it, you know, basically make desserts based on what they think the components are. And it was really interesting to hear people's, you know, some people are like, oh, this ice cream is black sesame, or oh, I think this is, you know, coconut, and I think this is that, and, you know, then when they took their visors off, they realized what the colors were, and, you know, pretty interesting. I think it was pretty successful.
And what was that analogy you made to orange juice at the beginning?
So, back in 1970, there was a study done, Journal of Consumer Research, basically, that they did tests on people where they took different, you know, they took orange juice and they colored the same orange juice differently, and then they separately took orange juice and they changed the sugar content. And people were saying that the flavors in the oranges were changing, like, you know, there was a much bigger variance in flavor based on the ones that had difference in color, but not difference in sugar level. So you taste two orange juices next together that are the exact same color, but one has a lot less sugar in it, and then the other one doesn't, and they thought that that was pretty normal. But then you have two orange juices that are the exact same but with different colors, and like, wow, this one's way more sour, this one's way more sweet, you know. So really explores like how people perceive things, you know, which is, I mean, that's something that like the, you know, the candy industry has been working on forever, and you know, industrial food, like making what we think is delicious, right? Like, you know, Heinz came out with the colored ketchups a few years ago.
Disgusting. Yeah,
and they're disgusting, but like, but they weren't, they're just ketchup,
exactly.
They're just,
yeah.
You know, that I told people at the beginning of the demo, what prompted it was actually Crystal Clear Pepsi, which to this day is still one of my favorite drinks.
Yeah.
It's delicious. You can't get it. And, you know, people completely rejected it. They didn't like it. They said, oh, it tastes like lemon lime, blah, blah, blah.
I think SNL did a skit about Crystal Clear Gravy at a point to mock it because it was such a phenomenon.
Right. Yeah. I actually remember that. It's hilarious. But, you know, it was like, and even as a little kid, like, you know, they came out in 1992. I was, you know, 9. And I was like, you guys know this is the same shit, right? This is the exact same product that doesn't have food coloring in it. Like, this is idiotic. I don't I'm not gonna. It's like that great scene from Zoolander. Like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's true. So we wanted, you know, we wanted people to have fun with it, and everybody seemed to respond really well.
Yeah, and it was interesting because Jordan actually had a big poster board which he wrote two words on, palette versus palette, which seemingly are the same word but actually very different. What do you define each palette as?
Well, there's, you know, palette in terms of the color palette, P-A-L-E-T-T-E, you know, that basically I put it up there because, you know, it's sort of a really cool, there's these similarities and these, you know, I'm not speaking very well right now. You can edit this, right?
No, not at all.
Fuck.
And you can curse too because it's online.
Online. Wonderful. Anyway, so, you know, like, and then obviously palette referring to your tongue. So, you know, palette and color versus palette on your tongue, like two things that should go hand in hand. But when you skew one of them, it really changes your perception. You know, I mean, I also had these people put on the red goggles, you know, 20 minutes before they got to see and taste and play with the food. So really got, they really were seeing red for a long time. And after, through prolonged, like when you just put it on and then you start tasting it, like your senses are there. But like when you're seeing only like this deep, deep red for, you know, 45 minutes, starts to mess with you a little bit.
So are you interested in maybe eliminating other senses, like having a dinner without smell?
I mean, I'm not about, it's not about sort of, you know, eliminating or, you know, making people, you know, heighten your other senses and things like that. That's all certainly interesting. I'm not sure that I would do a dinner like that because, quite frankly, one of the best parts about the meal is the smell. I mean, I would much rather be able to taste and smell my food than see it, even though color is really important to me. But, you know, this was just a way that, I guess, for years I've been battling with, you know, getting into arguments with people about food coloring. And, you know, let's say I make a sweet potato ice cream and I add 2 drops of orange food coloring to it. Most chefs would be like, oh, that's bullshit. Like, oh, we don't add any colorings or additives. You know, our food's all natural, blah, blah, blah. It's like, but they have no problem boiling down animal bones and using gelatin to put in their dessert. Like, that's not really not, I mean, it's natural, but it's not really, like, for sure, obviously it came from a natural point at some point in its life, but that doesn't really, to me as a pastry chef, that doesn't really make any more or less sense than using food coloring to augment. It's not like we're taking something that's white and coloring it red to make it taste like raspberry. We're taking raspberry puree that maybe is light pink or not quite red enough, and you add 1 or 2 drops and it makes it a really deep, vibrant color. And so when people see that on the plate and when they eat it, they're like, wow, that is super raspberry. It's unbelievable. You know? And then we give them the same sorbet that's lighter in color, like, the flavor's kind of, you know.
Well, it's kind of like trying to retain its purity in color, which is hard to do sometimes when you cook with certain ingredients. Jordan and I were actually just talking about an interesting occurrence called synesthesia, which is a reinterpretation of senses almost with another sense. So you're smelling color, or, you know, you're seeing flavor.
Right.
And you were just talking about an article that you had read.
Yeah, I mean, it's how there's a certain, it's extremely rare, but in certain people, sometimes the brain, the senses get mixed. And so, like Michael was saying, you know, you can, when you see a number, like, it's, the number is a color in your brain. Like, I know that the number 2 is pink. You know, it's very strange. And there was a certain gentleman that I was reading, it happened with food, and there's a few people that it happens with food, and every time he ate chicken, he saw the color blue. Every time he ate green beans, he saw the color orange. Like, you know, that obviously is a very sort of unique and rare kind of thing, but it's still kind of interesting how your senses, you know, can fuck with each other, basically.
Yeah, and it's not universal. I mean, it's kind of inherent to the person how they interpret, but yet we have overall flavor profiles of certain things.
It's true. You know, I mean, you have, if I give you a bowl of yellow Jell-O, what flavor is it to you?
Probably banana. Probably lemon, yeah.
See, but banana and lemon are very different.
You know?
Is that bowl of Jell-O going to be sour? Is it going to be sweet? Is it going to be passion fruit, lemon? Is banana? You know, like, there's, in everybody, when they look at it, like, the you know, whether you're aware of it or not, like, your instincts tell you, like, what it's going to be before you try it. You know, so it's kind of, it's something that I've always been really interested in, and it's really interesting how, you know, all that kind of plays in together, you know, because a lot of, I don't want to say naturalists, but a lot of people, you know, like, oh, you know, you look at their food and it's not terribly pretty, like, oh, my food's not very beautiful, but it tastes great. It's like, well, yes, but also it needs to be beautiful. It doesn't need to be beautiful, like, tortured into purees and all these different modern techniques, but it, you know, if you're doing something naturally, it should still look like what it is, you know?
Yeah, it's true. You eat with your eyes. You kind of carry this mantra with you, though, about dissonance rather than the universal, spawned from Chopin. Can you explain?
Sure. The name of the workshop was A Coloristic Use of the Dissonance, and a writer many years, long time ago, wrote that Chopin is a master of the coloristic use of the dissonance, which effectively dissonance is just sort of another word for, you know, describing something that is not... that's not parallel, something that maybe is a little bit skewed or a little unusual or, you know, out of the ordinary. You know, dissonant sounds are sort of not harmonies. They're, you know, contradicting in a lot of ways. So I think that really describes a lot of the food that, you know, chefs are doing around the world, and a lot of, and the food that I do, you know, the food is, has dissonance in it. And I felt that, you know, it, when he said that about Chopin, he basically meant that, you know, he was so poetic in his playing that you could literally, it would cause you to emote, you'd be happy and extremely sad, and you'd become lethargic, or you'd have, you know, you'd be upbeat. Like, it's, his music is really sort of powerful, and it also translates into colors. I'm actually doing a main stage demo tomorrow, which you're not going to be able to attend, which is bullshit.
Yeah.
it's basically exploring, it's called La Révolution Surréaliste, and it explores three different artists, one surrealist, one from the Romantic period, one from abstract expressionism, and it sort of is a video interactive kind of demo where it basically explores how, you know, incorporating the elements of surrealism or romanticism or abstract expressionism into food, not necessarily just into presentation, but also in overall, like, how you conceive the dish. You know, because, I mean, surrealists were, you know, they're a group of people, and they either believed in what they did or they didn't, and they weren't surrealists anymore, you know? Like, it was sort of a conscious effort, and then they used their own creativity to harness it in their own individual ways. So, Chopin is the romantic that I actually chose for the main stage demo, so we're going to see, his part of the demo is based on a conversation between him and Delacroix, and one night, it was a rainy evening, and Delacroix was talking to Chopin about how his tones and his music were so deep and vibrant that it often made him think of colors, and this one particular night, a certain way that he did it, he started seeing the color blue, so there's a bluish hue to the whole dish, and, you know, it's got raindrops represented because it was raining that night, and, you know, it's got kind of a gloomy feel to it. So I was basically it's not a demo exploring, like, my specific techniques about how I make things. It's more about, like, how I arrived at putting them together, sort of trying to get the audience into moods of each piece. There's three movements, you know? So it's like, maybe people will emote a little bit. People might get excited in certain parts and, you know, feel down a little bit. And at the end, we have this really unbelievable, crushing sort of masterpiece song. Oh, by the way, did I mention that it's all narrated by music? No spoken word to the entire demo.
Excellent, excellent. So, I mean, sound, too, often overlooked in food, from, you know, Rice Krispies popping in your mouth was an inherent sensation while you were a child, but there's an ethos, an emotion attached to that. So, yeah, using all the senses in the presentation.
He has a conch shell with an iPod Nano in it, or a shuffle, and you can hear, like, the sound of the sea while you're eating oysters. Like, it's really, really great. I mean, he's probably the biggest expert on exploring how to fuck with people's senses. I wouldn't try to say that I'm anywhere near where Heston is with his research, but I definitely find it equally as interesting, and you know, try to find my own way of showing it to people, you know.
But at the end of the day, Jordan also makes delicious food. Opening Red Medicine in LA soon. Do check him out, and thank you for being a guest on the Food Scene.
Hey man, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network, actually taping off-site at Star Chefs ICC. It's an international culinary congress, and funny enough, or you know, succinctly enough, it's about art versus craft, and I'm here with a old friend, fantastic chef, Gabriel Bremer of Salts in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who I was lucky enough to know while he was opening up the restaurant in 2004 and got to spend time in the kitchen, even got to do some amuse-bouche, cutting up radishes and I think putting crudo on plates a couple times. So he not only influenced me with food, but also aesthetically. His plates are precious, but they're precious in a way, not that you don't want to eat them, but precious because you realize how much thought, understanding, and technique goes behind it. We were just listening to a main stage conversation with the likes of Dan Barber, Michael Roman, Thomas Keller, David Kinch, and there was a very interesting statement by Thomas Keller saying that, you know, you have to be a craftsman before you have to be an artist. And then Dan Barber followed up talking about Velázquez, you know, an amazing painter who Picasso ended up remaking, repainting one of his most famous masterpieces over and over until he got it right. And it wasn't until then that Picasso went into his blue phase, went into, you know, more experimental and felt comfortable enough to be himself. Now, how do you feel about the idea of, you know, or the saying, being a craftsman before an artist?
I would have to agree fully, and I think as putting in my words in a conversation that we had earlier today, when we were just speaking, you need to learn to walk before you can run. Otherwise, you're just going to trip all over yourself and make a mess. And I think that's almost a big problem that a lot of younger cooks these days, you know, they look at people like Ferran, they look at all the modern cooking techniques, and they're like, okay, when do we get to use hydrocolloids? Like, well, first make me a hollandaise. Can you do that? Can you break down this fish? These are the basics that you need to know. The rest of it is icing on the cake. It's ways of reinterpreting or reconfiguring or expressing yourself. But if you don't know the fundamentals, what are you expressing? How can you express anything? It'd be like, you know, as you mentioned, Picasso trying to express himself, but he has no paints or no brush. You know, you need the tools before you can create your work, which will eventually, I think, turn into, in some people's case, art.
Yeah, and aside from just the tools, too, you need art in your life. And did you grow up around much of that influence?
Constantly, through all the art forms, through music, which I originally trained 14 years classically. I was supposed to be a percussionist. I even turned down a full scholarship. And then ended up cooking and continuing on this path. But I was constantly exposed to art museums, to theater, to ballet. And I think that shows up as well in the cooking in what I do at the restaurant. That's transmitted through the plates. And also, as far as my classical training in sort of the running of the kitchen.
How so do you mean?
Again, you need to know your basics before you can play. You know, sometimes I refer to a tasting menu is kind of the difference between the regular menu is kind of the classical trained. Everything has its place, its purpose. The jazz is almost like our tastings that we get to riff off of it and play. So I constantly still utilize my music background in the kitchen.
So, I mean, do you actually have a like Lydian Theory or offbeat tasting menu?
Depends on what people request.
So, I mean, has music, too, aside from just the training of being a percussionist, have certain songs influenced a dish?
Songs not per se, but certainly in the whole aesthetic of the restaurant, the music that we play in the dining room is just as important and is part of the entire atmosphere. So does a certain song inspire a dish? No, but do certain songs together inspire and create the mood of what is our restaurant? Yes.
So it's music isn't just periphery, or, you know, these outside idiosyncrasies or touches aren't just, you know, secondary, tertiary things to food. I mean, it's all encompassing.
Exactly. The smallest detail makes up the biggest.
We're back. This is Michael Harlan Turkel, your host of the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network, actually taping off-site at Star Chefs ICC this year, the topic being art versus craft, and I'm here with Alex Dupac, the pastry chef at WD50, lauded and known for, molecular gastronomy, but I think there's a lot more to be understood than just this progressive scientific cooking, especially of Alex's. Knew him when he was in Boston at Clio, even prior to that, cooking the line at Federalist, or were you just pastry at the Federalist?
No, the Federalist was my first pastry chef job ever, but it was also simultaneously my first and last sous chef job ever. I started there as a line cook, I became sous chef 2 months later, and what had happened is while I was there, they more or less the upper management decided to fire their pastry chef. Before they came up with a game plan of how they were going to fill that position. I really had always kind of had it in the back of my head that I'd like to give pastry a try, and that's when I seized it. I just said, come on, guys, just let me take it over. And I ended up working both jobs for a while, and then what happened was finally it was easier for them to replace me and get another sous chef than to find another pastry chef, and that's how I got my first gig doing pastry.
And Alex's pastry is actually slightly indescribable in the sense because he's been breaking the mold, and I mean that even literally, you know, straying away from the ideas of industrial silica and using even PVC piping to make certain dessert elements. What was the impetus for that kind of switch?
Sure. I mean, in terms of using PVC pipe, there's very pragmatic reasons for that. At the end of the day, whether we like it or not, pastry chefs are slaves to molds, because it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. It's a good thing because it's exemplary of what pastry is, or what the most meaningful part of it to me, which is that we're actually coming very close to creating new foods, we're creating new forms. But because we're human beings, we're prone to building clunky geometric shapes. We can't make anything as beautiful as a tree, or even take it to food. We can't make anything as pretty as a leaf, or, you know, a piece of fish or a piece of meat with these natural organic qualities to it. So we have this tendency to make things into circles and squares and spheres. A part of what I like to do is try to find a way to get away from that. I've never gotten away from it completely. I don't think it's possible. But if I can add an organic element, to at least one, to a plate, to sort of wed, you know, geometry with just natural anarchy, the visual part of it becomes a lot more intriguing. As far as PVC piping, I mean, honestly, molds are expensive. Like, yeah. All these pastry molds that people buy they're like $10-15 a piece. And if you work at anything like the restaurants I work at, you're going to need 50 or 60 of them for one dessert.
And custom molds cost thousands to initially make, right?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like, first you have to commission a designer to make something for you, and then you have to pay for it by piece, and then you're right back where you started, actually worse off. You're still paying $10, $15 a piece for these things. PVC pipe, you know, I would call my dad and, like, you know, my first pastry chef job, and I'd be like, hey, can you go to the hardware store and, you know, pick up some and cut it to this shape, or, you know, and he would do it for me. So, I mean, it's very, very low-tech, borderline ghetto mold making, but, you know, it was a start.
You were just talking, too, about how it pseudo-aligned with art theory, or the idea of moving from modernism to post-modernism. How can you kind of explain that?
Sure. Well, again, I'll preface everything by saying, you know, I'm not a art history buff at all, and if anyone's listening, you know, don't hate me. I just bought my first book on the last 100 years of art theory, you know, and I've been trying to penetrate it as best I can. But I feel like a lot of what I was reading about the transition from modern art to postmodern art equates to kind of what's happening to cooking right now, or at least personally for me. I feel like in the last, you know, 30 years in cooking, the focus has been on developing the new technique, finding the innovation, less about the dish or the flavors of it, but finding a way to actually manipulate food that's going to change the way other people do it, which is extremely valid and it's extremely important. But what has happened, I feel, is that it's hit a dead end. A lot of the avenues have been exhausted, in that you're not going to find a lot of new chefs out there who are going to create new methodology. I mean, I feel like cooking has changed more in the last 50 years than it has in the last 5,000. And I know there are others out there that agree with me. In what I'm reading, you know, in these art books I'm buying, is that this happened. This happened in the art world already. And it's simultaneously depressing but also reassuring and inspiring for me, because it's not our fault. You know, these avenues are going to, you know, you're going to hit a dead end. But then, you know, it just seems like, you know, when you breach into the postmodern mentality, things become a lot more pure, because, you know, to put it simply, you can do whatever the hell you want. It doesn't matter anymore. As long as the art is beautiful, it's okay. As long as the food is delicious, it's okay.
So what's an example of a do whatever the hell you want dish that you have on the menu right now or hoping to introduce to WD's menu?
Well, here's a simple idea of something I've done that just kind of bridges the gap. You know, in pastry, it was really hot for a while to come up with an ice cream that had a very unexpected flavor. You know, people began incorporating vegetables or, you know, savory items into their ice creams, and that threw everyone for a loop. And I just did this as a test. I just put this out there in the restaurant to kind of prove the fact that sometimes it's not just the picture you paint, but what frame you put it in. I pretty much decided that the craziest flavor ice cream I could ever serve at WD50 was vanilla. So I served vanilla ice cream. And I was right. That's what threw people for a loop. To take it further, the dish wasn't just vanilla ice cream. It was vanilla ice cream that was served rolled in a raspberry streusel, and it had balsamic vinegar at its center. And the funny thing about that is that it comes off as a flavor pairing that's innovative enough for a restaurant like WD50. But honest to God, the flavor pairing came from a conversation I had with my wife. My wife's a pastry chef. She's a pastry sous chef at the time at Babbo. And every summer when they get strawberries in season, they serve them with ice cream and some good balsamic vinegar drizzled on it. But it becomes funny to me, because if you serve a dish like that at Babbo, it's perceived as classic Italian because that's where you're eating. But if I take that dish and serve it in a slightly different way at WD50, people are, you know, lauding it as innovative. And is it? Maybe, maybe not. But it comes, who's making the dish? Maybe the judgment is biased.
Yeah, well, maybe breaking the mold is breaking methodology.
Yeah.
You know, switching that up and putting it anew on a plate rather than creating new crazy flavor combinations.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's so many avenues towards creativity, but I think my point is that I feel like the perception of what creativity is it's changing for me personally.
Thanks, Alex. You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Terkel, and we're actually taping on site today from Star Chefs ICC at the, what is this, the Armory, Park Armory, Park Avenue Armory, and I'm here with Kristen Murray, a dear old friend, actually met at Number 9 Park in Boston when she was pastry chef and have always been inspired and blown away by her work. Most specifically, can't get out of my mind this dish, brioche sassafras.
It's the sassafras brioche croustillante, and I think it was with red currants and a goat's milk ice cream, actually. Yeah.
And I don't know what it was. I mean, it was, well, it's not very common elements, but it was so comforting and, like, felt not safe, but like a warm hug, almost, in this way that she constructs dishes that have elements that you're used to, but don't necessarily come from the food world to be influenced. Are there any outside, you know, artists or mediums that inspire you to put these dishes together?
Oh, God. I think we were talking earlier, and just I love Kandinsky, just the lines, and just the visual is really striking, and the color. Miro was always a big draw. When you're talking about the croustillant, I'm thinking of the sassafras. There was a woman, Eva, that would passionately, she was very eccentric and call very breathy when we talked about herbs, but I always had this visual of her, which was very Renaissance almost, or just ripping these huge sassafras roots out of the ground, and I'd get so much, I can't curse.
Yeah, you can.
Okay. I would get so much shit because basically all this dirt would get everywhere when she brought them in, but it was so raw and beautiful, and I think kind of trying to take pastry from such an earth-based where it's not just seasonal, but you're really just appreciating the art of the ground or the air, sea, whatever is around. What else?
So, I mean, it's nature and natural forms that Moreau and Kandinsky that were using that kind of influenced the foods and the plating.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, just being back in New York and how industrial and fantastic and dirty it is. It's just, I've been playing with cocoa powder lately and pressing different shaped things into it to do faux chocolate casting. And I love how you think of chocolate showpieces, and they're normally these ornate, really finicky, bright, non-edible masses, which I guess would be something very Baroque. And I love that I'm kind of doing something that feels very Latin American or African, where it's just so wild and earthy and cocoa-y, and then you get to etch in the little detailing. And I think I took an old nail file that I never used and a makeup brush, and ended up really just kind of whittling and chiseling. There's an amazing artist that I'm blanking on that's from Belgium that does chocolate sculpture. And his last name starts with a P. But he's been a big inspiration lately to me.
So aside from worldly ingredients, it seems like you're getting into worldly cultures that influence your work, citing, you know, Africa and, you know, this artist himself. What kind of cultures are you looking at for, aside from eccentric ingredients, but inspiration?
I've always kind of been a food history geek. I studied art history like we talked about, but oftentimes after I would talk to farmers, I would read food history books and then get true inspiration out of that. Spain has always been a big one, but Africa and islands and just things that are kind of tribal and wild and not precious or endeared as of yet.
But it's more, that it's kind of funny because I picture those places as where the majority of raw ingredients come from. And I don't mean raw like raw food, but more so, you know, cacao or coffee. And
yeah, well, there was a woman, the vanilla sponsor here was talking about how Madagascar vanilla is now taking on a lot of cacao properties because there are more plantations. that are being planted. And so I think just like any good butter, milk, ingredient, it really takes from the source. So, but I'm inspired by pretty much just about everything. I could be inspired by a small ant crawling across the floor. If he had a funny walk or something, I would think about a crazy tweel to do that would be his jaunt. Yeah, it's hard to not get inspired by everything that's around and want to translate it into a way that's not obvious but interesting.